After Japan surrendered in August 1945, Vietnam's situation was actually very awkward. You must understand that before being effectively controlled by Japan, Vietnam was not a truly sovereign state. It had been colonized by France for 62 years, a period spanning two generations. The Nguyen Dynasty emperor was merely a figurehead, lacking any real power, and only nominally retained his throne in northern Vietnam. Therefore, many people in southern Vietnam had forgotten the existence of the Nguyen Dynasty emperor. They only knew that the actual control of Vietnam rested with the parliament and the governor general's office. From 1943 to 1945, due to the madness of the Japanese, the Vietnamese people suffered 3 years of hardship. This suffering, of course, cannot be blamed on the French governor general's office. Now that the disaster was over and Japan had surrendered, in the eyes of a large number of people in southern Vietnam, the return of the French governor general's office was paramount and undeniable. However, the Vietnamese Communist Party had already occupied the entire Hanoi Plain region in the north and had declared the establishment of a new government on September 2nd. The Democratic Republic of Vietnam was established. Ho Chi Minh, with his extensive political experience, deeply understood that it was necessary to seize power first and establish a regime under the banner of national independence. This was the general consensus of the international community at the time. As long as the appearance of an independent state was presented, it would inherently possess legitimacy. At the same time, to avoid being recognized as a communist regime by countries like the United States and Britain, Ho Chi Minh's North Vietnamese regime deliberately abandoned all characteristics associated with communism. The main measures included 3 points. First, abandoning the title of Communist Party. All Vietnamese party members collectively referred to themselves as members of the Marxist Study Society. Second, abandoning typical socialist policies such as rural land reform and confiscation of private assets, instead employing conciliatory methods to win over the Vietnamese people. Third, imitating the Vietnamese parliamentary system, establishing a national assembly and reserving a quarter of the seats for private citizens, electing civilian representatives through a popular vote. Furthermore, to gain more support from the general public, the North Vietnamese regime announced large-scale tax reductions, including exemptions from personal income tax, market tax, slaughter tax, and trade licenses, and various miscellaneous taxes such as land tax. At the same time, the North Vietnamese regime invested heavily in repairing roads and water facilities that had been destroyed by the U.S. military in the later stages of World War II to restore agricultural production. Regarding the various levels of grassroots administration left over from the colonial era, most of the personnel remained in their positions to ensure stability and social order. With this combination of policies, the economic order in North Vietnam was indeed quickly restored. Of course, with this approach, while significantly reducing taxes, they also had to bear huge social operating costs, and the North Vietnamese regime would inevitably be in a state of deficit. However, Ho Chi Minh was not worried about this. He was already adept at obtaining aid from the Soviet Union, and now that he had political power, a base of operations, people, and weapons, it was even more justifiable to receive aid from the Soviet Union. Therefore, the North Vietnamese regime easily survived, and during the chaotic period after the end of World War II, its territory expanded southward, showing an unstoppable momentum. Here's a side note. On the very first day of its official establishment, the North Vietnamese regime announced the abolition of Chinese characters and the complete implementation of a romanized national script. Even the French, who ruled for over 60 years, did not announce the abolition of Chinese characters. Now, with the establishment of the Vietnamese communist regime, abolishing Chinese characters became a top priority amidst all the other pressing matters. This arrangement fully reflects the collective political leanings of the Vietnamese communists. They never had any fondness for China. For so many years, many Vietnamese communists, including Ho Chi Minh, lived in China for extended periods, but all they saw were continuous warfare, widespread poverty, and the extremely brutal political infighting within the CCP. That's all. They couldn't possibly have any respect for their Chinese comrades. Therefore, when they officially established a regime, the first thing they thought of was to completely sever ties with China and eliminate the last vestiges of Chinese cultural influence in Vietnam. I want to emphasize again that Vietnamese people have never had any positive feelings towards China at any level. Since being colonized by the French, their historical trajectory has completely diverged from China. In subsequent history, the only time Vietnam learned from China's experience was in 1954 when they launched the land reform movement in North Vietnam, which almost led to the complete collapse of the regime. From then on, the Vietnamese communists completely disregarded the path of learning from or drawing on China's experience, and gradually treated China as an enemy or competitor. Even Vietnam's Doi Mua, renovation and opening up, policy after the 1980s had absolutely nothing to do with China's reform and opening up policy at the time. Therefore, the logic of Vietnam learning from China's experience simply doesn't exist. Please, viewers, abandon this kind of wishful thinking. At any time, if you subconsciously think that Vietnam extensively adopted China's experience in reform, you are definitely wrong, without exception. However, countries like Britain did not recognize this newly established regime. Ho Chi Minh, as a founding elder of the Communist International, had an overly strong communist flavor. After World War II, the United States, the Soviet Union, and Britain held a military conference in Potsdam. Regarding the Vietnamese region, they decided to use the 16th parallel north as the boundary, with the northern part occupied by the Chinese Nationalist Army and the southern part by the Anglo-American Allied Forces, respectively taking over the military strongholds occupied by the Japanese Army. As for the North Vietnamese regime created by Ho Chi Minh, it was completely ignored. At this time, the Soviet Union's attention was mainly focused on Eastern Europe. Occupying and digesting the Eastern European countries had already overwhelmed the Soviet Union, so they didn't. There was excessive concern about Ho Chi Minh's North Vietnamese regime. At the time, the United States, the Soviet Union, and Great Britain did not anticipate that this military arrangement would lead to a war that would last for 40 years. By the end of September 1945, with Ho Chi Minh's North Vietnamese regime already established and operational, the Kuomintang, KMT, army entered North Vietnam, effectively taking over all military strongholds in the region, and immediately supported the pro-KMT forces in North Vietnam, establishing local self-governing regimes. For Ho Chi Minh, the KMT Army's actions were utterly absurd. Vietnam was never under the KMT's rule, and the Potsdam Conference's arrangements were not mandatory international obligations. The KMT could have completely ignored this arrangement and allowed his North Vietnamese regime to continue strengthening its rule in the region. Now, the KMT Army had traveled thousands of miles to take over his military strongholds and support pro-KMT forces, openly revealing their territorial ambitions. This was absolutely unacceptable. Consequently, the KMT army quickly clashed fiercely with the North Vietnamese regime. Although there were no large-scale battles involving tens of thousands of troops, hundreds of smaller skirmishes occurred. Contact battles at the human level occurred daily. Ho Chi Minh's core forces were originally trained by the Kuomintang, KMT, and now he had to fight against the KMT, his former mentors. Naturally, he couldn't win. The KMT army held a decisive advantage, driving Ho Chi Minh's forces out of all the cities in northern Vietnam, forcing him back into the mountains near the border with China to wage guerrilla warfare. Meanwhile, the British and American fleets, carrying over 6,000 French soldiers, entered southern Vietnam, quickly taking over Saigon and soon controlling the population. The people of southern Vietnam already had a great fondness for the French, so now that they had returned, it was considered a good thing to let them continue governing. For Ho Chi Minh at this time, his primary objective was to drive the KMT army out of northern Vietnam, so he decided to compromise with the French. In March 1946, the North Vietnamese regime signed the March 6 preliminary agreement with France. The core content consisted of 2 points. First, the North Vietnamese regime decided to abandon its independent status and merge with southern Vietnam, accepting French rule. Second, the French army would take over the administration of northern Vietnam. The military leaders in both Ho Chi Minh's regime and the French government knew that the North Vietnamese regime would never be able to implement the first clause of the agreement. However, both sides decided to implement the second clause. Ho Chi Minh could use this to drive out the Kuomintang, KMT, troops, and the French army could take the opportunity to seize control of key military strongholds in North Vietnam, achieving the goal of actual control over North Vietnam. In April 1946, under repeated pressure from the French government, the KMT troops finally withdrew from Vietnam. Of course, the French government's maneuvering was one factor, but the main reason for the KMT's withdrawal from Vietnam was that peace negotiations between the KMT and the CCP had broken down, and a civil war was about to erupt. Both sides were gathering troops and were about to engage in a major battle in the Central Plains region. In any case, after the KMT troops withdrew from Vietnam, the French Navy took over the naval defenses in North Vietnam, finally planting several strategic stakes in the region. Ho Chi Minh, meanwhile, returned to Hanoi from the mountains and resumed the operation of the North Vietnamese regime. After this, the North Vietnamese regime began lengthy negotiations with the French government. While negotiating, both sides were also making their own military preparations. The North Vietnamese regime began to establish guerrilla forces in South Vietnam. The Viet Minh forces conducted deep military infiltration. Meanwhile, the French intensified their troop deployments, strengthening their military presence in Vietnam. By December 1946, both sides believed they were ready for war, and the conflict officially began. In the initial stages of the war, the French held a decisive advantage. The Viet Minh army had only recently completed training and organization, and had only participated in a few small-scale battles, lacking experience in large-scale operations. Therefore, they were constantly pressured by the French. However, the Viet Minh army learned from the war, improving very quickly. They also received endless weapons aid from the Soviet Union, and Vietnam's long coastline could not be completely blockaded by the French, preventing them from cutting off the Viet Minh supply lines. Therefore, the French advantage quickly diminished. By October 1947, the Viet Minh army pushed into the northern mountainous region, fully utilizing their advantage in mountain warfare, defeating a French offensive of over 20,000 troops and achieving victory in the Northern Vietnam campaign. This was the Viet Minh's first victory in a battle involving more than 10,000 troops. After this, the French army was no longer able to launch a truly effective offensive against the Viet Minh, the offensive stalled, and both sides entered a long period of stalemate. In fact, this stalemate was precisely a common weakness of the French. They were never good at fighting protracted wars. Once the enemy's will to fight became strong, the French themselves would soften. During the long stalemate, both sides tried many methods. On the French side, they began to implement a blockade policy against the North, severing trade between the North and South and halting all commodity circulation. Vietnam thus entered a long period of North-South division. In June 1949, France re-established Emperor Bao Dai of the Nguyen dynasty, transforming South Vietnam into a so-called constitutional monarchy to win the support of pro-monarchy forces within Vietnam. Meanwhile, the North Vietnamese regime began to train a large number of guerrillas, launching continuous guerrilla warfare throughout South Vietnam. This included, but was not limited to, destroying power and water facilities, bombing and burning important supply depots, placing bombs in important municipal institutions and ports, and assassinating high-ranking officials in South Vietnam. Ladies and gentlemen, today, when you look at these so-called guerrilla tactics, terrorism can certainly be equated with one word: terror. Terrorism, especially its tactics, is undoubtedly about spreading terror on a large scale to destroy the enemy's ability to mobilize. In fact, this strategy did have a huge impact. The people of South Vietnam feared the North Vietnamese guerrillas like tigers, and the French and their puppet emperor in South Vietnam had great difficulty recruiting soldiers. This stalemate continued until the end of 1949. At this time, the newly established People's Republic of China witnessed tens of thousands of defeated Kuomintang soldiers from Guangxi entering Vietnam and joining the South Vietnamese army. The strength of South Vietnam increased dramatically, and they launched a series of offensives against the North. The Kuomintang Guangxi army was originally one of the most capable fighting forces. Strictly speaking, they were even the teachers of the North Vietnamese army, and therefore had a strong psychological advantage against them. The participation of this powerful force immediately changed the long-standing stalemate. By mid-1950, they had driven the North Vietnamese army to the coast and into the mountains along the Sino-Vietnamese border. Ho Chi Minh was truly, there was no other way. Although he personally and the entire high-level management team of the Viet Minh were very reluctant, they could only make a helpless choice and request the newly established communist regime in China to send troops to fight in Vietnam. After July 1950, General Chen Zheng and General Wei Qing led the Chinese People's Liberation Army, PLA, reinforcements to the Sino-Vietnamese border area and began to organize border battles. In September, with Chen Zheng as the commander-in-chief, the Chinese PLA as the main force, and the North Vietnamese army as a flanking auxiliary force, they officially launched a counterattack against the French. This battle caught the French off guard. At that time, the Red Chinese Army had already undergone rigorous training on the battlefield, and its combat skills were among the best in the world. The tactics of frontal assault and flanking maneuvers that the Red Army learned from the Japanese were something that neither the French nor the surrendered Kuomintang soldiers could counter. As a result, the French army suffered heavy losses, and by October, they had lost the entire North Vietnamese region that they had just recaptured, retreating to the south. After Chen Zheng achieved victory in the border battle, he led his troops back to China. However, the Chinese advisors, led by Wei Guoqing, the group of over 200 people remained in Vietnam. They imparted the Red Army's military tactics and experience to the North Vietnamese army system. According to later work records, the details of the Chinese advisory group's work even included correcting the North Vietnamese soldiers' habit of sleeping with their rifles in the alert position, and the division of labor within squads and platoons when suddenly encountering the enemy. The North Vietnamese army was thus transformed, becoming stronger and stronger with the assistance of the Chinese advisory group, while the French army gradually fell into a completely passive position. In 1954, the North Vietnamese and the French finally engaged in a decisive battle in the Dinh Bien Phu area. Dinh Bien Phu is located in northern Vietnam, at the border of Vietnam, China, and Laos. This location is actually quite remote, but because it is in a tri-border area, it has strong political significance and was the last stronghold of the French in northern Vietnam. The French had been operating there for a long time, reinforcing their military equipment through long-distance air transport, transforming the small town of Dinh Bien Phu into a military monster composed of reinforced concrete and heavy artillery. The French idea was that occupying Dinh Bien Phu would plant an unremovable nail in northern Vietnam. The French could stand in Dinh Bien Phu and launch counterattacks in any direction. By 1954, during that year, everyone's attention was ultimately focused on Dinh Bien Phu. Everyone understood that if France lost Dinh Bien Phu, it would lose its last chance to counterattack. After that, NATO troops would surely march straight south. Faced with this situation, China provided firm support. The Korean War had already ended in July 1953, and China's heavy weapons had been gradually transported back to China from Korea. China did not hesitate to provide an entire heavy artillery unit with all its weapons and ammunition, along with experienced artillerymen, to assist the Vietnamese army in combat. On March 13, 1954, this heavy artillery unit began a relentless bombardment of the entire Dien Bien Phu area. The density of artillery fire that the Chinese heavy artillery unit tested in the Korean battlefield could unleash was beyond anything the French could imagine at the time. The French endured a hellish 3 days and three nights of continuous bombardment. On March 16, the French lost all their outposts and retreated to the central fortress. What followed was a month-long battle for the fortress. Under the command of the Chinese advisory group, the Vietnamese tactics were very flexible. Before officially attacking any fortress, they would inevitably, first, they launched a heavy artillery bombardment. After the bombardment, the infantry immediately charged forward, coordinating their attacks perfectly, eliminating a batch of French troops every day. On the outskirts, they carried out targeted attacks, wiping out French reinforcements as they arrived, and even filming the battles and broadcasting them live to the world every day. To the world, the Dien Bien Phu battle looked like a one-sided massacre of French troops by the Vietnamese army, shocking the world and leaving everyone speechless. This continued until early May, when the French army on the front lines and the French government finally collapsed. On May 7, the French forces at Dien Bien Phu announced their surrender. The Vietnamese regime and the French government immediately began negotiations, and a result was quickly reached. In July 1954, the Vietnamese regime and the independence movements of Laos and Cambodia signed the Geneva Accords with the French government. The content concerning Vietnam mainly consisted of 2 points. First, France officially withdrew from Indochina, ending the colonial era in the Indochinese peninsula. Second, South Vietnam and North Vietnam were divided by the 17th parallel. The North belonged to Ho Chi Minh's Vietnam, while the South belonged to Emperor Bao Dai, who everyone knew had long existed as a puppet ruler. In fact, they did not have the ability to protect the territory of South Vietnam. The so-called Geneva Accords were merely a meaningless document reflecting the French desire for a graceful exit, but there was nothing they could do. At this time, the French had been intimidated by the weakening of their forces by the Viet Minh, and they would never dare to fight again. In fact, from then on, the French never appeared on any battlefield anywhere in the world. The joint efforts of Vietnam and China permanently removed France from the stage of war. Of course, the story so far is only the beginning. The suffering of the Vietnamese people in the war was far from over. The war between North Vietnam and the French was generally civilized and did not harm innocent civilians. The French never launched any form of attack on civilians, and even stopped attacking when civilians appeared on the battlefield, allowing North Vietnamese soldiers and civilians to escape together. However, the Vietnamese civilians were about to endure real war suffering. In October 1955, South Vietnam held a referendum to abolish the puppet Emperor Bao Dai, and Ngo Dinh Diem became the first president of the Republic of South Vietnam. In April 1956, the last French troops withdrew. In the south, the situation in Vietnam thus transformed into a conflict between Ho Chi Minh's North Vietnamese regime and the Republic of South Vietnam. At this time, the U.S. government issued a stern warning to both sides, stating that neither side could initiate war and that peace in Indochina must be maintained. Consequently, Vietnam experienced a brief period of peace. From 1956 to 1961, Ho Chi Minh's North Vietnamese regime primarily focused on mitigating the disastrous mistakes resulting from the so-called land reform implemented after 1954. I have repeatedly explained this principle. The socialist model can be applied to the industrial sector, but not to agriculture. Once the so-called planned economy and collectivization model are forcibly implemented in the agricultural sector, it will inevitably provoke strong resistance from farmers, leading to a widespread decrease in food production and subsequently a terrible famine. After the Battle of Dien Bien Phu in 1954, the French army withdrew from North Vietnam. Under the guidance of Chinese advisors, the Ho Chi Minh regime believed that the time was ripe to begin building a beautiful socialist state. Therefore, the North Vietnamese regime began implementing the so-called socialist transformation movement. The movement in the cities, it must have been about confiscating the capitalists' property. However, at that time, Vietnam's industry and commerce were mainly concentrated in South Vietnam. The North Vietnamese regime didn't have much to confiscate, so they could only accept the advice of the Chinese advisory group and launch land reform in rural areas, which meant inciting poor farmers to fight against landlords. However, the situation in North Vietnam was fundamentally different from that in China. Vietnam simply did not have the problem of land scarcity or land consolidation. Under French rule, Vietnam had been prosperous for more than 60 years. The people lived in peace and contentment, and there were ample means of livelihood. The fertile Red River Delta was full of undeveloped land, and the established rural areas were all self-sufficient farming communities. If they wanted to cultivate land, there was plenty of undeveloped land available. The former French governor's office tried every means to encourage people to cultivate more land. Or, to put it another way, in prosperous Vietnam, there was simply no such thing as a landlord. The Chinese advisory group introduced China's land reform experience to the North Vietnamese regime and, in a semi-coercive manner, pushed North Vietnam to implement the so-called land reform, which only artificially created a disaster. As a result, a massive catastrophe began throughout North Vietnam. During the land reform in North Vietnam, the Chinese advisory group drafted a complete land reform plan, held training classes, and trained more than 20,000 land reform cadres. They also set quotas for identifying landlords, requiring that 1% of the population be identified as landlords, and then 1/10 of these landlords be identified as counter-revolutionary landlords and executed. In early 1954, these land reform cadres, following the orders of the Chinese advisory group, went down to every village, forcibly identifying so-called landlords from among the villagers, and then forcing other villagers to criticize and denounce these innocent landlords. The people of North Vietnam were deeply resentful of this, and countless people fled their ancestral villages, escaping to the South Vietnamese region. By March 1956, when the Chinese advisory group left North Vietnam, 180,000 civilians in the entire North Vietnamese region had been forcibly identified as so-called landlords, and more than 10,000 of them had been executed. This practice was absurd to an unimaginable degree. By June 1956, peasant uprisings had occurred throughout North Vietnam, with a number of peasants participating in the uprisings in provinces such as Anh and Kien Giang exceeding 10,000. The North Vietnamese People's Army generals collectively, by refusing to suppress the peasants who participated in the riots, and with a large number of soldiers deserting, the North Vietnamese regime faced a high risk of being overthrown overnight. In September 1956, after repeated debates within the North Vietnamese regime, it was decided to end this extremely absurd farce. Ho Chi Minh, who served as the chairman of the North Vietnamese government, issued a public statement acknowledging the mistakes of the land reform. Truong Chinh, who was then the general secretary of the Vietnamese Communist Party and the primary person responsible for the land reform movement, announced his resignation, and Le Duan took over. All the people who had been arrested on charges of being landlords were released, their reputations restored, and they received compensation from the North Vietnamese government. From this incident onwards, the North Vietnamese regime no longer accepted any political or economic advice from Red China. In fact, this incident also laid the groundwork for a fundamental change in Vietnam's political model in the future. Truong Chinh, a key figure in the North, was considered a true moderate within the Vietnamese leadership. He had previously served as the second in command and was the tacit successor to Ho Chi Minh. After this incident, Truong Chinh withdrew from the power struggle and held various ceremonial positions for a long time. Le Duan then took over the position of second in command. The reasoning behind the land reform was typical of the Southern faction. The Southern faction had no fondness for China because the Chinese Communist Party promoted the absurd and utterly wrong policy of land reform and struggle against landlords. The Southern faction was filled with disgust towards the Chinese Communist Party. This was also one of the triggers for the war between China and Vietnam in the 1980s, but I will elaborate on this story in the third part. After 1956, the Vietnamese Communist Party spent more than a year appeasing the angry people. After 1958, the Vietnamese Communist Party began to implement the rural cooperative model in a relatively gentle way. This model originated in the Soviet Union and immediately led to disastrous consequences. Now, the Vietnamese Communist Party is implementing the cooperative model in the North Vietnamese region. It has learned from the lessons of the previous land reform and struggle against landlords and has not resorted to extremely violent means. Let me emphasize again that the Red River Delta in the north is fertile and has a warm climate, which is very suitable for growing grain. In 1958, the cultivated and irrigated area in the Red River Delta reached 2 million hectares, and the grain output reached 4.9 million tons. At this time, the total population of North Vietnam was only about 14 million, and the per capita grain availability reached 350 kilograms, exceeding the daily requirement, exceeding 1 kilogram. What does this data mean? China only barely reached this figure in 1985. In 2025, North Korea's per capita food supply is 300 grams, only 1/3 of the NATO food supply level in 1958. This means that in 1958, the North Korean region did not lack food at all, and the people were all in a state of adequate sustenance, without extreme hunger. Therefore, the North Korean region had a strong ability to withstand turmoil. As long as the North Korean regime didn't act wildly, killing people, implementing population control plans, or forcing people to fight against each other, and only implemented collectivization in rural areas, the North Korean region could withstand it. The collectivized rural cooperative model deprived farmers of ownership of their output, only allowing them to receive a certain proportion of grain for their own needs, which would inevitably lead to a decrease in food production. However, at this time, the North Korean region's food production was very large. As a long-term food exporting region, the decrease in food production did not have a significant impact on the North Korean regime. It was already under a blockade, and international trade had long since ceased. The only way it could obtain supplies was from the Soviet Union, and Red China received aid, so the rural collectivization movement was reluctantly pushed forward. During the implementation of collectivization, the North Vietnamese regime did not adopt a completely uniform approach. It simultaneously implemented a large number of conciliatory measures. For example, it allowed farmers to retain 5% of their private land, with the replanting costs of this land entirely borne by the cooperative. At the same time, it allowed farmers to raise poultry and livestock, and also allowed them to engage in handicrafts to supplement their income. Because of the existence of these conciliatory measures, the actual income of North Vietnamese farmers did not decrease significantly, so the farmers' resistance was not very strong. After the 1960s, the Chinese government was overwhelmed by successive famines at home. Therefore, the Chinese government, in turn, learned from North Vietnam's experience and began to implement these conciliatory measures in the collectivization movement. From 1956 to 1959, the main work of the North Vietnamese regime was to deal with these complex rural issues. There were no major military conflicts between North and South Vietnam during this period. The North Vietnamese side sent a large number of spies and guerrillas to the South during this period, carrying out large-scale infiltration. However, these people did not organize any significant activities, terrorist attacks. After all, North Vietnam and South Vietnam were originally one family, bound by blood. Even the North Vietnamese guerrillas wouldn't commit terrorist attacks to bomb and kill their South Vietnamese compatriots. This brief period of peace lasted until 1959, when the South Vietnamese regime began a very absurd undertaking, establishing so-called strategic hamlets, concentrating millions of farmers from the border areas into designated settlements and establishing a strict household registration system to purge the hidden North Vietnamese guerrillas in the countryside. In fact, this was a large-scale forced population relocation movement, requiring extremely strong social mobilization and control capabilities. However, the South Vietnamese regime at this time was a republic established on a parliamentary model, imitating France. The parliamentary model itself did not possess this kind of mobilization capacity. To put it this way, in 1993, the total number of people relocated for the Three Gorges Dam project in Communist China was only 1.3 million, yet Communist China mobilized national political resources, from the state council to local governments, and used the entire nation's strength to resettle them, barely managing to complete the relocation task. Even then, these Three Gorges migrants still launched countless large-scale protest movements, which continued until the 2010s. Red China spent immeasurable management costs and financial resources on this, meaning that any forced large-scale population migration will inevitably trigger countless acute social problems. The foolish actions of the South Vietnamese regime directly shattered the peaceful situation. The forcibly relocated people found themselves without housing, water, or electricity, and all the relocation conditions promised by the government failed to materialize. Crucially, such relocation activities inevitably involved large-scale official corruption, which was easily exposed. Faced with this situation, the people naturally rose up in rebellion. The North Vietnamese guerrillas seized the opportunity to launch attacks on the local government, and their attacks were highly effective. The border areas of South Vietnam were thus engulfed in turmoil, and border posts fell one after another. This situation continued until 1961, when the United States officially intervened in this absurd situation in South Vietnam. However, the United States did not push the then existing regime to correct its flawed strategic hamlet policy. The American approach was to form special operations forces to work with the South Vietnamese government to try to eliminate the North Vietnamese guerrillas. In other words, the root of all problems lay in this strategic hamlet relocation plan was implemented by the South Vietnamese regime, but the United States and the South Vietnamese government made no revisions to it, instead attempting to use military means to eliminate the Viet Cong guerrillas in the north, which was, of course, impossible. With the support of the angry South Vietnamese farmers, the Viet Cong guerrillas grew larger and stronger, rendering the U.S. Special Forces and the South Vietnamese government powerless to retaliate. In November 1963, a military coup finally occurred in South Vietnam, and Ngo Dinh Diem was assassinated. After the new government came to power, it audited the so-called Strategic Hamlet Plan, and the results were shocking. Less than 20% of the 8,600 strategic hamlets in the plan met the minimum construction standards. Therefore, the strategic hamlet plan was completely abandoned, and the South Vietnamese regime allowed all farmers to remain in their original locations. However, this back and forth depleted the financial resources of the people, and the South Vietnamese regime did not provide any compensation to the farmers. The South Vietnamese regime lost the hearts and minds of its people. Everything needs to be viewed in comparison. The North Vietnamese regime was indeed a socialist regime, and it did implement collectivization. However, the North Vietnamese regime was able to acknowledge its mistakes in launching the land reform campaign and courageously correct them, providing full compensation to the farmers who were wrongly judged. Compensation. Subsequently, the North Vietnamese regime's collectivization movement was also very moderate, and the measures taken were not extreme. Meanwhile, in South Vietnam, which claimed to be a republic, the most autocratic things were happening. A strategic hamlet program involving millions of farmers completely depleted the farmers' resources, and no compensation was given afterwards. This was blatant thuggery. The South Vietnamese regime lost the support of its people, and its demise was only a matter of time. Even with all the support from the United States, its collapse was inevitable. In August 1964, a U.S. warship clashed with the North Vietnamese Navy in the Gulf of Tonkin. The U.S. government determined this to be a military attack by the North Vietnamese regime and subsequently launched large-scale airstrikes against North Vietnam and deployed U.S. ground troops to key military locations in South Vietnam. Vietnam thus entered a state of full-scale war. In 1965, the North Vietnamese Regular Army crossed the 17th parallel into South Vietnam and began engaging in direct combat with U.S. forces. The fighting escalated from small-scale skirmishes to large-scale battles involving entire armies. The North Vietnamese Army had all the advantages. It had the unwavering support of the South Vietnamese farmers, and in South Vietnam, the North Vietnamese government and military had countless spies within the South Vietnamese government and military, giving them an unparalleled intelligence advantage. Any actions by the South Vietnamese and American forces were known to the North Vietnamese government even during the planning stages. Ambushes against American forces could be planned with precision down to the platoon level, while North Vietnam also received almost unlimited military support from the Soviet Union and China. China, in particular, provided systematic knowledge to North Vietnam, entrusting the entire air defense, logistics, and transportation operations in the North Vietnamese region to Chinese personnel. At its peak, the number of Chinese logistics personnel stationed in North Vietnam exceeded 320,000. This meant that North Vietnam had no worries about its rear. The war was not a burden for the Ho Chi Minh government, nor did it increase the burden on North Vietnamese farmers. Therefore, the stronger the North Vietnamese army became, the worse the situation became for the South Vietnamese government and the American forces. This mutual slaughter continued until 1968, when North Vietnam completed its preparations for a full-scale offensive. In late January 1968, the North Vietnamese army launched the Tet Offensive, an interesting battle that yielded no tactical gains but was a complete strategic victory. North Vietnam deployed 80,000 regular troops and over 300,000 irregular forces. The attack was launched simultaneously against more than 40 cities and over 60 towns and villages in South Vietnam. Farmers in South Vietnam also took the opportunity to riot and attack local administrators. This offensive lasted for more than 2 months, continuing until early April. The final outcome was that all attacks were repelled, North Vietnam failed to occupy a single area, and the North Vietnamese army suffered heavy losses, with many units even being completely annihilated. However, this offensive psychologically devastated the American people. American citizens watched on television as wave after wave of North Vietnamese troops launched suicidal attacks. They were already uninterested in the U.S. government's involvement in this distant war of unification in the East, and now there was widespread condemnation. The incumbent U.S. President Johnson was overwhelmed by this, so he publicly announced that he would abandon his re-election bid, stop bombing North Vietnam, and seek negotiations with North Vietnam. This meant that after the Tet Offensive, the United States intended to extricate itself from the quagmire of Vietnam. In January 1969, Nixon took office as President of the United States, and his first priority was to withdraw troops from Vietnam. Nixon acted very quickly. In June of that year, Nixon delivered a public speech announcing that the United States would no longer bear the full responsibility for defending the free nations of the world. In July, more than 50,000 American troops began an organized withdrawal from Vietnam. By the end of 1969, nearly 100,000 had been withdrawn, and by the end of 1970, 300,000 remained, and by the end of 1971, only about 100,000 were left. Throughout the entire withdrawal process, North Vietnam and the United States engaged in protracted, back-and-forth negotiations. In reality, there wasn't much to negotiate. The only point of contention was whether North Vietnam could tolerate the continued existence of South Vietnam. The U.S. side was only concerned with saving face, hoping that the North Vietnamese government would at least formally accept the South Vietnamese regime. As for what the North Vietnamese regime wanted to do with South Vietnam after signing the agreement, the U.S. government could simply claim it had taken a stand. On the North Vietnamese side, Ho Chi Minh died in September 1969, and he did not live to witness the reunification of North and South Vietnam. Later, the people of South Vietnam showed no respect for this nominal leader of Vietnam. Le Duan took over as the leader of North Vietnam. At this time, Le Duan was overconfident, seeing that the U.S. was withdrawing its troops, and therefore resolutely refused to give in. The United States, unwilling to lose face, resolutely refused to officially recognize the existence of the South Vietnamese government in writing. Given this stance, the U.S. government took a serious approach. In late 1972, the U.S. military launched Operation Linebacker II, deploying its most advanced B-52 bombers to conduct a continuous 11-day carpet bombing campaign against strategic targets in all North Vietnamese cities, dropping 20,000 tons of bombs. All North Vietnamese cities, road networks, power plants, water facilities, defensive positions, and government facilities were reduced to rubble in this operation. This bombing immediately awakened the hot-headed leaders of the North Vietnamese regime. They suddenly realized that if the U.S. government were serious, they could only retreat to the mountains and wage guerrilla warfare. With North Vietnam's strength, it was absolutely impossible to defeat the world's leading superpower. Therefore, just 1 month after this bombing, on January 27, 1973, North Vietnam, South Vietnam, and the U.S. government reached a peace agreement. North Vietnam formally promised to preserve the South Vietnamese government. I will briefly summarize the subsequent history. The United States completely withdrew from South Vietnam within the next 2 months. The previous regime left countless weapons and medicinal supplies to the South Vietnamese government, enough to fight a world war. However, this arrangement proved useless. Lee Kuan Ren endured for a year, giving the American government ample face. By early 1974, Nixon was deeply embroiled in the Watergate scandal, and his presidency was on the verge of collapse. He had no time to worry about Vietnam, and the North Vietnamese army immediately launched an offensive against the South. In April 1975, North Vietnam captured Saigon, and 10 days later, South Vietnamese President Duong Van Minh announced his surrender. Vietnam was thus unified. However, the situation changed very quickly. Just as North Vietnam completed its unification, the Khmer Rouge seized power in Cambodia. This was a completely inhumane regime, and they would launch a shocking internal genocide and massacre that would stun the world. The tide of history surged forward, about to draw more characters onto the stage, and China and Vietnam would thus begin a century-long competition. They would engage in a comprehensive contest in all areas, including military reform and economics. I will discuss these details further in the next part, the Sino-Vietnamese Border Conflict. Produced by Lauman. Please stay tuned.